From WBOI Fort Wayne and Monstrous Regiment Media, this is Women Are Fort Wayne, a podcast highlighting the amazing things women are doing in Fort Wayne, Indiana, the struggles we face, and the tools that help us rise. I'm your host, Stephanie Gottesman, a Fort Wayne transplant and entrepreneur, getting to know my new home through great conversations with inspiring women. Join me and get to know things you may not have discovered about our charming Summit City. Hi, everybody. Welcome back to Women Are Fort Wayne. If this is your first time joining us, thank you for tuning in and welcome to our show. I know that we've all been impacted by the COVID-19 pandemic and that many of us are, quite frankly, sick of hearing about it. I get it. I'm exhausted, too. This pandemic is decidedly an endurance test for many of us, and there is so much conflicting information out there that it can feel confusing and overwhelming. I feel you on all of that. I hope that all of you are taking time for self-care and finding ways to fill up your wells and stay connected to the people that you love. For those of you who don't know me well, I'm the sort of person that wants as much accurate information as possible from the most reliable sources. I find comfort in data and structure. Too much chaos and confusion leaves me feeling anxious and depressed. I know I'm not the only person out there who feels like this, so I decided to use this episode to get some answers directly from reliable sources. I did this as much for myself as for all of you, and hope that the information I found through these interviews will help put some of your minds at ease as well. We'll be speaking with three different women with unique insight into the pandemic: a representative from the Department of Health, a person that has recently recovered from COVID-19, and a mental health professional that works directly with other medical professionals. Each of these women has a different perspective on the pandemic, and they all have some valuable information, tools, and resources to share that can help all of us cope a little bit better from a more informed place. I want to be upfront with all of you. Some of the things that I learned from these recordings were challenging. I invite you to listen to your body and your heart while you're listening to what these women have to say. If you're feeling overwhelmed by any of it, take breaks. We're all in this together, and this episode is here to help you stay informed and prepared for the months ahead. Our first guest is Erica Pitcher. Erica is the Director of Community Health and Case Management for the Allen County Department of Health. She worked alongside Health Commissioner Dr. Deborah McMahon right up until her retirement a few weeks ago, managing Allen County's response to the COVID crisis. I've been following the Department of Health's website since they launched their COVID-19 pandemic page back in March. It's been a fantastic source of data on where our county stands, as well as resources and things like testing, safety, and mental health. I'm really excited that I was able to get this interview and really grateful to everybody at the Department of Health that helped me find the right person to talk to for this show. So welcome, Erica. Thank you so much for being here with us today.
Yes, thank you for having me.
It's truly an honor to be able to interview somebody that is actually working on this pandemic firsthand. It feels like something of a gift to be able to ask all of the questions that I have, but that I'm sure other people have as well. So thank you for taking the time.
Yes, not a problem at all.
So tell us a little bit about what you do as the Director of Community Health and Case Management.
Well, before COVID-19 started, my division, it's a group of five of us in total. We are responsible for investigating all conditions that are reportable. So there's about 82 conditions, and those are things that you hear of frequently: salmonella, E. coli, tuberculosis. We even follow up with animal bites to see if there's any potential for rabies exposure. So that's what we do any given day, treating patients, tracking outbreaks, counting cases, reporting data, you know, things along that line. So when COVID started at the beginning of January, we started watching it through some of our infectious disease networks. It's just a small cluster of pneumonia cases that were being reported out of China. And then since January, pretty much all I've been doing is planning and educating and preparing. And then I did lead the team that was responsible for all of the COVID-19 case investigations here in Allen County, all the contact tracing. We track all of the cases and report all of the data that you see that we release to the media.
So what does that contact tracing actually look like? How does that work?
So I'll give you two different perspectives. So if you weren't aware, the Indiana State Department of Health actually took or rolled out a new program of contact tracing on May 18th. So they have been doing that since May 18th. But before then, we had our first case here on March 19th. So for the 2 months before that, contact tracing was very in-depth and detailed. We had a crew of five people. We worked basically 24/7. We worked every night. We worked weekends. And as soon as a case would be reported, we would contact those people, one, to be sure they were aware of their diagnosis, to provide guidance on what to do. So one of the big things is, are you infectious? And what period of time have you been infectious? And where all have you been during that period of time? And who all have you been around? So the way you determine someone's infectious period with COVID-19 is you take whatever day they develop symptoms. So that first day they started coughing or developed a fever, whatever that first symptom was, and you add 48 hours to that. So you go back 2 days before symptoms started. And then that person is considered infectious from those 2 days before symptoms until 10 days have passed and they've been free of fever for three of those days. So that could be 10 days, that could be 3 weeks. You know, it's very dependent on each person and how the virus presented itself in that person. And so then what we would do with those people is look at that window of period. Who all have they been around? Do they work? Do they go to school? And then we made those follow-up calls to whatever entity or person was potentially exposed. And there's a ranking system to figure out who was high risk and who was low risk. And those people that were deemed to be high risk contacts, which at that time, it was anybody that was within 6 feet for greater than 10 minutes without any personal protective equipment, such as a mask or goggles or a face shield, which most people don't wear. They would be considered high risk, and we would be advising them to stay at home or quarantine for 14 days past the last time they were ever around that person. So, you know, some people might already be a couple of days into that quarantine by the time we would find them. But that was a big part of what we would do. So, you know, some investigations were very easy because the person hadn't been anywhere, they didn't work, a pretty quick phone call. And then, you know, we of course had very involved investigations too, where there were several exposures that we would have to contact. And then at the very beginning, we would call those people every single day to check to see if they had symptoms. That did change once the cases grew. We were no longer able to call and check in. So then we asked them to call us if symptoms did develop. And then we would advise them on how to seek medical care if needed. So that was what we were doing when it was our process that we were following. When the state took over on May 18th, it switched. It's now a call center and all of the information gets reported into a database. And at midnight, that data dumps into the database and a blast text message is sent out to all of the new cases. And so we always try to encourage people, if you get a text message that says, you know, please call the Indiana State Department of Health, please take that seriously, because that is the process that Indiana is doing now. So now the state will send a text message. They ask people to call them. And then if they don't get a call, they will then reach out and proactively call them and also send them a letter. But they will then complete the investigation asking the same questions that we were asking, and they report all of that data into their system. We are still involved in contact tracing. If there's anybody that needs assistance, if somebody's put into quarantine and they need groceries or, you know, some type of life necessity that we're not allowing them to leave their house to go and get, we will step in and assist with getting those things. There are some people that the call center cannot find. We consider those people lost to follow-up. Maybe they don't respond to the text message or they don't answer the phone calls. So we will then follow up at the local level, maybe do a home visit and see if we can find those people, because it is very important that we make sure, one, people know that they're positive. We make sure that people that are infectious are staying home, and people that are at risk of becoming sick are aware and they are also staying home. So we are still involved. We are just not the lead of that anymore. And that was true for all counties, as I said, on May 18th, that rolled out across the entire state.
Thank you. It's really great to hear how that works, because it's, you know, that was one of my questions is, are we doing contact tracing? What does that look like in this county? Is that something that we've been taking seriously? And it sounds like it is. It is. So thank you for all. Sorry.
Yeah. Go ahead. Oh, no, that's okay. And the call center works 7 days a week as well. So we try to stay on top of the cases to the best that we can. So as long as people are taking it seriously, calling everybody back and providing the information, it is hopefully a very timely and effective process.
For anybody listening that thinks they might have COVID and wants to call that call center, where can they find that information?
That is a very good question. So the number to call the call center directly is not a publicized number. So if you think you have COVID and you want to be tested, you can call the local health department and we can help with where you can go to be tested. If they live in Allen County, it would certainly be us. They could call 449-7556. That would get to my division. And we can help providing those locations. There's several free drive-through clinics in town, several local providers, the hospitals are testing. So if you don't live in Allen County, certainly call the health department in your area and they could provide that guidance.
There seems to be a lot of conflicting ideas out there about where things actually stand here in Allen County. I know that some people seem to think that the threat has passed and that we can just go back to life as usual now. Is that the case?
So I don't feel that that's the case here in Allen County. We keep what's called an epi curve, which is that hashtag flatten the curve movement that you see. And what that is counting your cases every day. And you know, you're hoping that the case count doesn't continue to go up. And what we have seen since the state has started to reopen is an increase in cases. You know, we were averaging about 15 to 30 cases a day, and now we're seeing maybe more like 50 to 70 cases a day. So it's not significant, but it is more. And you know, it's really tough because there are a couple of variables that all switched around the same time. So state started opening back up, which obviously more people are out and about. So we're going to see more people interacting with each other, more opportunities for transmission. Testing capability greatly increased over the last several weeks. Initially, when the pandemic first started, the State Department of Health had very strict criteria that you had to meet in order to be tested. So basically, only the sickest of the sick people that were hospitalized, and they even needed to have, you know, they required a certain level of care. It wasn't just a hospital admission. You know, those were the only people that were being tested in the beginning. And now somebody can drive through a drive-through clinic off the street without any symptoms and be tested. So we don't know the denominator of tests that were being done, say, in April versus June. So it's really hard to say, are we seeing more cases or are we just testing more people and finding more infection? It's really hard to say. So I always caution that when I say the data, because yes, our cases are up, but there are several reasons why they could be up, not necessarily because we have a bigger issue in our community. So given the data that we have, it's really hard to say specifically. So we've been working really hard to caution people that it is still here. We're still getting record level number of cases, and you still need to take precautions when you're out in public.
So let's talk about that for a second. What steps do you recommend people take right now to protect not just themselves, but their community from this pandemic?
The most important step and the easiest step is to stay home if you don't have to go anywhere. Only do essential trips. If you have to go out, you need to make sure you are masking. That could be a surgical mask. That could be a cloth facial covering, a homemade cloth mask, a bandana. You could take a t-shirt and tie it around your face if you wanted to. You know, masks are really only effective if everyone is masking, because you wear the mask, especially if it's a cloth facial covering, not for yourself, but for the other people, because that's catching the droplets so they don't come out of your mouth and disperse into the air. So if you go into a store and you have a cloth facial covering on, but nobody else in the store does, you're protecting them, but nobody in that store is protecting you. So it's very important that we have a large enough percentage of people wearing a mask so that masks are even effective. So definitely wear a mask when you're in public. Try to socially distance, which is staying at least 6 feet. You'll see new studies coming out saying the recommendation is now 10 feet, but at least 6 feet minimum. Washing your hands frequently. Warm soapy water is always best, but if it's hand sanitizer and that's all you have, that's certainly appropriate. Just make sure you are still washing your hands throughout the day. And staying home if you're sick, or if anyone in your home is sick, I always tell people, nobody knows your body better than you. If you're feeling off, you know, stay home or be extra vigilant when you're out. There's no, you know, we hear a lot of criticism. Well, masks aren't effective or socially distancing isn't effective. And without a treatment and without a vaccine, we don't have anything that's a sure thing right now that will help us. And so what we have is a series of tools that we can use to lower our risk. And all of those tools need to be used in order for them to be effective. So we have to have people that are sick staying home. We have to have people masking. We have to have people keeping distance between others. And when we do all of those things together, they work enough to prevent widespread transmission in our community.
So it sounds like from what you're saying that masks are more about civic responsibility even than personal protection. Is that right?
When you're in public, yes. I mean, obviously when you're in a healthcare setting, that's a different situation and they're wearing a different level of mask. But yes, when you go out into public and you're wearing a cloth facial covering, you are doing that for the people around you, not for yourself.
And how effective are cloth masks?
They say that if two people have a cloth facial covering on, it's about 80% effective. So again, not 100% effective, but if you're then 6 feet from those around you and you're washing your hands, you know that even increases your effectiveness even more.
I really wish that instead of calling it social distancing, they had actually called it physical distancing, since it is really about the distance that you're leaving between people. Is that more of an accurate way to think about it?
Yes, it is. And I've actually heard that criticism a lot because it has gone on for so long. Social distancing has caused a lot of problems with people feeling isolated and alone. And so, yeah, it's not that you can't speak to people, it's that you can't physically be close to people. So it is more of a physical distancing that we're asking people to do.
If I'm understanding this correctly, and it seems like I am, that means that there's still a lot of things that people can do to stay healthy and safe this summer that can help with the feelings of isolation. Could you give us some examples of things that would be safe for people to be out doing?
Being outside is very minimal risk, especially if you're staying away from others. So you could go to parks that are open and walk. Obviously, you know, we would hope that you weren't playing on play equipment with your children, but hiking in parks, walking in parks, bike riding, anything that's out and open. Certainly, if there was something indoors that you wanted to do, you could safely do it if you were able to mask and keep a safe distance from others. So there's a lot that can still be done safely. It's just being diligent with how you're doing it so that you're not only protecting yourself, but those around you.
So one of my listeners actually sent in a couple of questions when she heard that I was going to be speaking with you. One of them is, if you socially distance gather with friends in your yard, is it safe to let them use your bathroom if you clean up afterwards?
I would say so. Here's the one thing that you need to think through is that if that person were infected, and we know that they could be infectious up to 2 days before they're actually feeling sick. So even though they feel healthy and fine, they could be infectious. That virus does hang in the air for a period of time. So if you do clean your bathroom, you're cleaning the surfaces. You know, if you're really wanting to be diligent and you're very concerned about it, I would close your bathroom door and let 4 hours pass before you go in there. Just to be safe. They say it used to be that you would hear that the virus hangs in the air for about 2 hours. Most recent studies have shown it's about 8 minutes. We always caution 4 hours just to be safe because things change all the time. It's a brand new virus. We're learning more about it every day. So, I mean, if you want to be overly cautious, that would be my recommendation. It's safe for them to come into your house, close your bathroom door for a period of time before you go in. That will allow the virus to settle out of the air onto the surfaces, and then you could wipe the surfaces off of them.
Would it make a difference if when they came inside they were wearing a mask?
Yes, then you wouldn't need to do that at all. So,
okay, so it sounds like it would be pretty safe as long as they wore a mask when they go inside.
Yes.
Yep. That's wonderful. What about things like petting somebody else's dog? Is that something that's still considered unsafe?
No, that's okay. We just, you know, as we learn more and we learn more about surfaces that the virus lives on and things that it doesn't live on and how long it lives on those surfaces, the best blanket recommendation we can give is after you touch anything that is not yours, you just wash your hands or use hand sanitizer. So it's perfectly safe to pet a dog. It's perfectly safe to touch your groceries. It's perfectly safe to open your mail. Just wash your hands when you're done before you touch anything else.
That's reassuring, to be honest.
Yeah.
Thank you. So I have kind of a personal question around antibody testing. I fall into the category of people that thinks they had it. Me and my family got sick back in March, early March, and we had been traveling up to Michigan in the weeks before that and had friends that came on that trip that were flying in from other states. Our symptoms matched COVID, but because of when we got it, we were not qualified to get an actual test since our cases were relatively mild, which is saying something because what we experienced was not what I would consider a mild experience. So the information about how to get antibody testing is a little confusing, and I've heard so many mixed things on whether they're even accurate. What does the Department of Health have to say about antibody testing?
So there are several different antibody tests on the market. There's only one or two, a very small number of tests that are actually FDA approved. And here's what you have to keep into perspective. We have only known about this virus for 6 months, and we've really only had widespread testing for 2 months. And when we learned about this virus, when it was declared or identified in January, there was no testing at all. So even the nasal pharyngeal swab or the PCR test that is the true confirmatory test that will be done, that had to be developed in order to even identify this virus. So then to develop less sensitive tests such as the antibody test, those things take time to perfect. And to have 6 months to do it is just not enough time to collect enough data to show how many people are going to have false negatives, how many people are going to have false positives. These are things that all other tests have gone through for Lyme disease, Salmonella, E. coli, all of that. It's just they've been around for years and decades, and the tests have been able to be fine-tuned. And there just hasn't been enough time with COVID-19 yet. So the PCR test, which is the nasal pharyngeal swab that you'll see most people doing, is a highly accurate test because it actually looks for the genetic material, the DNA of the virus. And so it's either present or it's not present. So that's a pretty sensitive and specific test. Now, for antibodies, what that's doing is it's measuring your body's immune response. So there's not even a lot of scientific studies available that show how long does it take your body to develop antibodies after you've been exposed. For instance, if you get a flu shot, we know it takes about 2 weeks before that flu shot is going to protect you against the flu if you're exposed. So for COVID, that's something they're working on. Is it 2 weeks? Is it 2 months? So if you get an antibody test too soon, it might say that it's negative when actually your body's still just working on transitioning from active infection to antibodies. So there's a lot of misinformation, there's a lot of unknowns, and there's a high probability that you could have a false negative or a false positive. So those tests are available. I wouldn't discourage you from getting it. If you want to get it for your own knowledge, just know that there's a chance whatever result you get might not be true. And also those tests, that's called a serology test, which is a blood test, those aren't counted in our case counts. So you're only considered a confirmed case in the state of Indiana if you have that PCR test, that nasal pharyngeal swab, and they look for that genetic material. Right now, the antibody testing is just not sound enough for those cases to be counted as confirmed cases.
That makes a lot of sense. So from a public health perspective, is there a beneficial reason for those of us who think we may have had it to go get that antibody test?
If we could trust the results of the antibody test and we knew that a positive was a true positive and a negative was a true negative, there would be great public health information that we could gather from that information. We are just not there yet. So right now, a bunch of test results that aren't really reliable aren't that helpful because it's not based off of sound scientific evidence yet. We will get there. It will just take some time.
And what about people who want to get tested but don't have insurance for whatever reason? Is there a way for them to get either the virus test itself or the antibody tests?
Yes, you can go. So Optum is a company that the state has a contract with. They are here locally. They're across the state, You can go to the Indiana State Department of Health. They have a page on their website that shows all the testing locations. But locally, it's at the New Haven Fire Department, and it's a drive-through clinic. It's a free clinic. If you have insurance, they collect your insurance information, but if you do not have insurance, they will test you for free. There are other places. I know CVS has some drive-through clinics. Neighborhood Health Clinic has testing clinics. That's on a sliding scale, but still cheaper than if you were to pay out of pocket at a private doctor's office or at the hospital. So there are several opportunities and locations here in town that one can be tested. And if you visit the State Department of Health website, you can access all of those locations.
One of the things that I'm personally concerned about is that I have a daughter who is usually in daycare. I know that there's no way to have conclusive answers. And I know that it is that daycares are allowed to be open right now. Mm-hmm. Is that something that you would consider safe? Or do you think that it's a better idea for us to keep having her at home as long as we can continue working from home?
I think that there are opportunities to make daycares as safe as we can. We will not be able to remove all risk. And I think that's kind of where we are just in life right now. You know, this is our new normal until we have a vaccine or we have a treatment, which will likely be at least a year from now, would be my speculation. So what we have to do is we have to learn to live as safely as we can. So some of us don't have the option to stay home, and you have to go to work, and that requires you to take your child somewhere. So daycares have guidance to make it as safe as an environment as they can, with teachers masking, having children play with toys separately, removing all soft toys that can't be disinfected routinely, like stuffed animals, blankets, you know, things like that. Checking children's temperatures, checking their symptoms as they come in. You know, there are so many levels of protection we can add, but again, none of that would ensure you that it's zero risk for your child. And if that's what you're looking for, then your only option would be to keep your child home. But you could do it as safely as you could with the right precautions. But again, there's still going to be minimal risk there.
How do you see the months ahead playing out around this pandemic? How long do you think it'll go on? And what can our listeners do to stay realistic and informed as this crisis continues to unfold?
I think it's a lot of that is going to depend on the public and on our citizens, how seriously they take it. We've kind of had a switch. And so initially, goal number one was healthcare must stand. We have to make sure we don't overwhelm our healthcare system. That's why everything went on lockdown, because we didn't have enough medical supplies. We didn't have enough ventilators, enough ICU beds. We had to make sure that if somebody needed care, they had the opportunity to get care. So we locked down, we stayed down, we allowed several weeks for our hospitals and our local doctor's offices to develop what they call surge plans and develop processes and teams and get the supplies that they needed so that they could care for a large number of people. So now, yes, we are counting how many cases we're getting every day, but the true measure now is, where are our healthcare systems? Are we overwhelming our healthcare systems? And we're in communication with our hospitals constantly to see, you know, are you seeing an increase in admissions? And that's where we get concerned, because in 2020, there's no reason somebody should die because they didn't have access to a ventilator or they didn't have access to an ICU bed. And that's what we have to be cautious of. So if everybody takes the precautions needed, masking, socially distancing, staying home when they're sick, staying home. The really challenging thing is, when you're sick, we ask you to stay home at least 10 days, but you might only feel bad a couple of those days. And you think, oh, I feel fine. I can go out to the store, or I can go back to work. I need the money. I don't have enough sick time, but you're still infectious during that time period. And so following the recommended measures that you're hearing from your local public health officials, the national public health officials, it's really going to gauge what happens. You know, I think it's really important that our schools figure out a way to get back in session. We have to develop life as a new normal. But in order for that to be successful, we all have the responsibility of taking it seriously, taking precautions, and doing the best that we can to make sure it's a safe environment for everyone around us.
So one more question before we start to wrap things up. I know that there is a perception out there that this is only a disease that is a problem for people who are older, people that are immunocompromised, people that are in high-risk groups. Mm-hmm. Do you feel like that's accurate, or is this something that is concerning for everybody?
This is something that affects everybody. So initially, when we started tracking our data, as I said, only those that were very sick and met certain criteria were being tested. So our data was very skewed to show that, you know, 75% of the cases were over the age of 65 and had chronic conditions. Now, when you look at that data, more of our cases are under the age of 65 than over the age of 65. The Indiana State Department of Health and the Fairbanks School of Public Health are doing a study you may have seen where they're randomly selecting people, sending postcards to their homes and asking them to be tested because they're trying to get a representation of the state to see how many people have been infected. And they're finding that about 40% of the people that they're testing are testing positive and they don't have any symptoms at all. So I will say that it does appear to affect people over the age of 65 and people with chronic conditions a little bit more severely. It does not discriminate who it infects, what the challenges that they might get a more severe case of it. So I don't think only those people need to be worried about it, because I keep saying, and I've worked here at the health department for 5 years, but I worked for the State Department of Health for about 5 years before that. So I've been studying diseases for about 10 years, and this disease, the way that it might present in a young 20-year-old person that unexpectedly spends 3 weeks in the ICU, and then a 60-year-old person might get it and have asymptomatic infection, it's just so hit or miss. There's not really a true pattern that we can follow, or a true risk group that we can say, because we've seen unusual cases in every age group. People that are young, people that are old, people with chronic conditions, people without chronic conditions. So I always tell people, act as if you're going to be the one that has the most serious case, so that you're taking the highest level of precautions when you're out in public.
I want to thank you again, Erica, for taking time out of what I'm sure is a very busy day to share all of this really valuable information with all of us. Before we wrap up, do you have any parting advice for our listeners as we look towards the future during this pandemic?
The best advice that I can give as we move forward through the next several months before we have a vaccine or a treatment available would be, you are responsible for not only yourself, but for your community. So, you know, while you're at work, you need to put it on yourself. If you touch an elevator button, you need to wash your hands. Certainly your workplace will be wiping those down, but not between every time somebody touches it. If you go out in public, you need to wear a mask. You can't assume that the air is going to be safe wherever you are. So you have to take that personal responsibility to watch out for yourself while you are in public. And then you also take responsibility to watch out for those that are around you. And the biggest thing is, you know, it can't last forever. It won't last forever. And if we do it right, it won't last nearly as long as if we do it wrong. So take the precautions now so that we can get back to what will be our new normal for life going forward much more quickly.
Thank you so much for joining us, Erica. It's really, truly been an honor.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. I was happy to be here.